Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I'm Craig. We have Kirk with us. I think JB as well. It's a tough day to hear those words about the land of Israel. It is a cauldron of Islamic terrorism at the moment. Israel is, for the first time, fighting an enemy within, as opposed to the last three times in the War of Independence in 1948, when Muslims tried to wipe out Jews, and then 1967 and 73. Those were all external attacks on Israel that Israel rebuffed, and I think we should probably cover them so we have proper perspective.
Sure.
But this time, the terrorists are Israeli citizens. So they are Palestinians, so-called Palestinians. And they have been deadly. And Israel is responding to the rioters and the looters and the murderers with police actions, and they just became more belligerent and more deadly. And then Hamas decided they would send, well, I think it's well over 1,000 rockets into Israel, trying to send all of them into civilian areas. And all the United Nations can do in the International Criminal Court is say, we're watching Israel. You know, your attacks on civilian areas is a war crime. It is astounding that the world is reacting as it is. But Israel is in a world of hurt at the moment.
Yeah.
And Israel made a horrible mistake. I understand the motivation for it, but had they been Torah observant, they would not have made this mistake. Well, a little history. A fellow named Chaim Weizmann created synthetic acetone during the midst of World War I. At the time, the Germans had all the momentum, and Europe was about to fall, particularly Great Britain. And in the trench warfare and the like, the British needed two things. One is smokeless gunpowder. Chaim Weizmann provided it. And the second was synthetic rubber for the tires of the mechanized vehicle. Chaim Weizmann invented it and provided it. And it saved the British Empire. And so he was asked at the end of the war, well, what is it you want can have anything. I mean, you've saved us. We'd be speaking German now if you hadn't done these things. All I want is my people's homeland. You now control it. You control it because, of course, the Brits, armed and bribed fundamentalist Islamic warlord throughout the Middle East, but particularly in Saudi Arabia, to attack the Ottomans. The Ottomans were shelling the Kaaba and Mecca. And so the Saud family teamed with the Wahhab imams, and they formed a militant group. Well, by the way, riding on horseback, swinging swords, not a very advanced culture. But with the Ottoman Turks losing battles to the Russians, then annihilating in genocidal rage 2 million Armenian Christians, and ruthlessly killing Kurds along the way, they were pretty well decimated, and it was not all that difficult to finish the job. And so the Brits reneged on the Balfour Agreement because Israel was going to be all of what is present-day Jordan, as well as what is present-day Israel. And that's what was given to the Jews, and the Brits reneged. They made an agreement. They dishonored the agreement because the Muslims that they had partnered with now had oil under their sands, and Britain and the United States thought that it would be really swell to pretend like the Middle East was theirs. And so the Brits took over countries. For example, they took over Iraq. So the United States countered with, well, then our territory will be Saudi Arabia. And they made these warlords deal to say, you know, you could have X percentage of the proceeds of the oil that we extract. So the West, the United States, and Great Britain built the refineries and extracted the oil and gave the warlords a cut. And after a while, the warlords said, no, we don't want a cut. It's all ours. We're confiscating it. They dishonored their agreements. And in the process now, Britain and the United States trying to hang on to their power grab for fuel, the easiest people to disavow were the Jews. They had no military. They had no oil. And so they capitulated on the Balfour Agreement because the Muslims demanded it. And yet what happened as a result of what the British did is that Jews were unable to migrate out of Europe and into Israel. And because they were unable to, Hitler capitalized, and we had the Holocaust, 6 million of them, 2 million of them killed by the Nazi Germans, who had collaborators throughout Europe, in France and the Ukraine, throughout Denmark, most of the Scandinavian countries, they capitulated. They played along with the Germans. There were a few resistors, but the majority of the population was anti-Semitic. And so after the war, and it was seen that no people had ever been treated so horribly as the Germans and Europeans had treated the Jews with the concentration camps and the crematorium ovens, that Israel was given their homeland, Israel back. And they did not establish the borders they had previously agreed to, and they put much of the land in a situation where they had no chance of prevailing. Gaza was carved out of it. The West Bank was essentially called the West Bank because it was part of Jordan. Gaza, of course, was controlled by Egypt. Now, no one in the world complained when Jordan controlled and occupied the West Bank. No one had any problem when Egypt controlled and occupied Gaza. So anyway, Israel is awarded a state in 1948, and Team Islam immediately decides that the only good Jew is a dead Jew, and that their response to the UN 242 Accord was to reject it and to go to war against Israel. Now, I've spent a lot of time in contract law, and if you have an agreement and you renege on the agreement is that rather than agree with the terms here, we're going to kill you. That agreement's no longer enforceable. You know, if you try to buy a home and the person is asking $500,000 and you offer $400,000 and they say, we'll accept $250,000 and, or should be, we'll accept $450,000 and if you accept their offer, you have a deal. If you counter that offer, then that offer is off the table. If the seller of the home says, no, we won't take the $400,000, but we will take $450,000, the people say, no, that was the most we're going to offer. They can't go back and say, well, then we'll accept your $400,000. Just kidding.
No.
So when Team Islam went to war against Israel in 1948 and said, we reject Israel as a country and we want to wipe the country off the face of the earth and kill every Jew in the process, they reneged on the terms of UN 242. Therefore, there is no going back to that agreement. It no longer exists. Now, it gets worse because in 1967, the Muslims, who aren't very good at being secretive, bragged, particularly Nasser and Egypt, that they were going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. They outnumbered them 100-1. And so it was going to be easy. All you needed to do is have a coordinated attack between Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq. And you get them all to Jordan to go against Israel simultaneously, there is a 0% chance that Israel will survive. And they brought in all of their war equipment. They were hugely equipped by both the United States and Russia. They had most advanced war equipment in the world, and they were within moments of pulling the string and attacking Israel en masse. And, of course, Israel survives by having good intelligence. And Israel said, no, I don't think so, and led a preemptive strike and took out the Egyptian Air Force, took out most of the Syrian Air Force. And by the time the Muslims figured out what had happened to them, the Jews were minutes outside of Damascus and minutes outside of Cairo. Had the United States not intervened, Cairo and Damascus would have been Jewish. The United States called them back. So it was one of the great tragedies of the United States to do so, but nonetheless they did. And it would be like the Mexicans saying, you know, you took Texas and New Mexico and Arizona and California through war. Therefore, you're not entitled to it. Therefore, you're occupying it. Therefore, give it back to us. And, of course, the exact same situation happens with these nations trying to destroy Israel, a worse from their perspective. And Israel successfully defends itself, but now there's a new rules that apply to Israel that apply to no other nation. You know, can you imagine the United States giving California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas back to Mexico? First of all, Mexico wouldn't take it. and the Mexicans would want it. Yeah, they would want it. But nonetheless, I digress. But against insurmountable odds in a war that no one could win, far greater than any uneven battle in human history, Israel, for the second time in a row, prevailed. So in 1973, the Muslims say, you know, we'll do this again, but this time we'll play it smart. We'll be quieter about it, and we'll attack them on Yom Kippur. That'll work. They'll be off celebrating Yom Kippur, and we'll destroy it before they even return to their posts. And so the battle begins with an air attack and with Russian tanks that outnumber the Jews more than 10 to 1. Vastly superior equipment, night vision in the tanks, top-of-the-line Russian tanks versus cobbled-together tanks that old steam gauges, nothing electronic in them. On the Israeli side, and almost no one at their posts. It should have been an annihilation, and Israel was attacked by Egypt on the south and Syria on the north simultaneously. It should have been, again, an annihilation. And yet one of the greatest miraculous victories in human history on Yom Kippur. The Jews prevailed. And they captured the Golan from Syria, and they captured the Sinai. They had it all. And yet the United States made them give it all back. Now, what the saddest thing was is that when Israel claimed the and liberated, really, the city of Jerusalem, they did not kick the defeated peoples out. When Israel was granted a homeland for the Jewish people after the Holocaust, rather than kicking the Muslims out, they offered the Muslim citizenship. Now, not smart enough to figure out, wait a minute, we were in Iran, they confiscated our homes, they either killed us or booted us out. We've been slaves, we've been mercilessly treated in every place we've been, we've had no rights. We've not had any say in the government. We've been treated worse than slaves in all of these Islamic countries. And yet now we have our own country, and we're going to treat the Muslims as full citizens. It was incredibly stupid. Anyway, they did it, and the Muslims became the best educated, healthiest, freest, most inventive, prosperous Muslims in the world. They were the only Muslims actually living in a democracy, the only Muslims that actually had rights and as a minority when Jews had no rights. And yet, that didn't look good for Team Islam. So what Team Islam decided to do is to start a series of intifadas, where rather than going to work and collecting a paycheck, you'd go to work with a gun or a knife and you would kill your employer. Unfortunately, too, when Israel took over the Jerusalem, they gave the Temple Mount to the Muslims, and they gave Jordan the right to manage it rather than take it. Now, I've read so many articles here recently that said that it is the third holiest site in Islam. It's the place where Muhammad went up to heaven. Bullshit. Bull. Absolute crap. Anybody that is actually a journalist that would read the goddamn story should be able to figure it out. Muhammad was in bed with a six-year-old girl. And at the time, he was dealing with the satanic verses. The Muslims in Mecca realized that he wanted sex, power, and money, and they offered him sex, power, and money. He accepted the deal. And the deal was, you allow our gods to play with your gods. And the chief gods in Mecca were not Allah. No. Chief gods in Mecca were Alat, Al-Uzza, and Manat. And Muhammad said, fine, yeah, they're all, the Quran verse, they're all up together in this. And when he was called on it by the father of the little girl that he was sexually abusing, he said, I take it all back. All of Allah's prophets speak on behalf of Satan. That's what became the satanic verses. Muhammad then was in a pickle, and he needed a way out of Dodge. So what he did is one night, still with Aisha, his little six-year-old sex toy, he imagines that he rode on a winged ass. Now, I'm going to tell you, asses can't fly. Probably didn't know that. He claims he got on a winged ass, and he flew from Mecca during the night into Jerusalem. And when he got into Jerusalem, he met in the temple with all of the Hebrew big shots. Yep, that's what he did. Now, there's a little problem here, because this is right around,
700?
Yeah, CE. The temple had been gone for over 500 years. Whoops! The people he claimed to meet with, Moses, Esau, who he thinks is Jesus, Adam, he had his whole list. They were long dead. So he's claiming that he's meeting in a non-existent temple, and he rode a winged ass into town while he's sleeping with a six-year-old girl. And then the Dome of the Hopi print is there because the winged ass leapt from the non-existent temple, and the first stop towards Allah's heaven was hell. So the only way you can get to Allah is to go through hell. I'm making this story up. This is what the Quran says. It's what the Hadith says. And of course, he ends up in hell, and it's filled with women, and he says, why are there so many women in hell? And why are they all hanging by their boobs from meat hooks? And he's told, because they were ungrateful to their husbands. If you're playing religious dress-up as a Muslim woman, you need to know that. He then went from hell up the ladder of the successive heavens. When he finally gets to Allah's joint, he asks Allah, what do you want? He says, I want to be moon 50 times a day. 50 prostrations a day. Oh, yes. A God that wants to be worshipped isn't worth knowing. A God that would create an inferior being to worship him is sick. That's the story. And based upon that lunacy, that obvious fallacy, Muslims claim the Temple Mount is theirs. They built the Dome of the Rock as a trophy, as a na-na-na-na-na, just like when they took over Constantinople. They turned the cathedral into a mosque. It was their way to gloat. It is a sore on human reason. To call it the third holiest site in Islam is to be absolutely stupid. Now, let's deal with the Palestinians. The reason the name Palestine exists is because when Hadrian lured Jews back to their homeland because he hated them and wanted to destroy them, he promised that he would rebuild the city after that horrible Roman beatdown in 70 CE where they destroyed the temple. So they will rebuild the temple. We'll do this all together. It'll be just swell. So when the Jews come back, swell, all right. He sought to annihilate them. Killed hundreds of thousands. Hauled them off into slavery in Europe. And as he was burning copies of the Torah around the literate Jews of the time and and crucifying them by the tens of thousands. Hadrian hears that the greatest enemy of the Jewish people had been the Philistines. So he says, all right, I'll show them who's boss. I'll build a temple to myself and one to Apollo right here on the Temple Mount, and we'll rename this place. It's no longer the province of Yehuda. We're going to call it Philistia. Therein is the birth of a place called Palestine. It's a misnomer. It's a lie. It's all based upon one of the great slaughters in human history, one of the most abominable acts by any civilization ever. That was Rome. And so because Europe is so anti-Semitic, because Europe was controlled for so many years by the Roman Catholic Church that grew out of Imperial Rome, they love the name. Oh, it's a Latin name. We're going to call it that because we hate the dastardly Jews anyway. We'll perpetrate the myth. Now, that myth outside of intellectual and religious circles was not well known until 1948. All of a sudden, 1948, you're going to rename the place back to its old name, Israel, and give it back to the people God gave the land to? No. Well, we've got a claim for that. We'll pretend the Arab Muslims in Israel are Palestinians. And that we'll pretend like the place is called Palestine. That will give us this illusion that it's our country and that the Jews are occupying it. It's all a lie. There hasn't been a Philistine on this planet for 2,500 years. The Assyrians killed the last of them. And even when they were there, they were not indigenous to the region. The Torah says they came from Crete. We finally have DNA evidence unearthed about 6 months ago, the first Philistine gravesite, because there's very little of Philistine the
infrastructure.
Philistines that they left behind. The only written language is actually Hebrew that was there. We have a gravesite. So they did DNA testing. Guess where they came from?
Crete.
Yeah. Yep. So the only place in the world where the name Philistine, therefore Palestinian, is known is through the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. There's no other place in the world. There's no other record of these people. If what the Torah, prophets, and Psalms says about them is true, then they're vicious animals who hated Yahweh, who hated Israel, and did everything they could to destroy Israel, and that they were wiped out by the Assyrians. Now, if what the Torah says is true, therefore there cannot be a Palestinian people or a place called Palestine. And if the Torah's account and the prophet account of them is untrue, then there never was such a people because they're unknown.
No, yeah.
So those are your choices.
Irony.
So stop it. All of you Islamic supporters, all you progressive liberals that hate Israel with your Palestinian rights and your boycott movements. You're completely ignorant of history and you're completely irrational and you're totally and completely immoral. Now, here we have, once again, the Muslims using their Ramadan festival as a call to violence, and all blamed on a few families being booted out of where are really Jewish homes. The bunch of homes in inside of Jerusalem that were owned by Jews prior to even Israel becoming a state again. And the history of the Jews owning them is clear, and they were confiscated by Muslims. And so after a series of battles in court, you know, and we're not talking about the way Muslims decide things. They went to court. They proved the case that these were actually Jewish homes and they were stolen from the Jews. And so they said, you know, you lost the court case after all this time. These are our homes. We will compensate you for them, even though you don't own them. But they were ours. You stole them from us. Oh, that was the grievance that justified them rioting. And Hamas wants to prove that they can take it to Israel with the PLO being inept with the ancient one who has nothing going for him, can't even appeal to Muslims. And so Hamas, prior to these elections, wants to prove that they're tough. And not hard to inspire a Muslim to violence. They commit 95% of the world's violent acts. So they started to riot. Now, there is a problem on the Israeli side, and that is that there are a bunch of religious right-wing fanatics now in Israel that are out marching on the streets saying, you know, death to Arabs. Stupid. Now, personally, if every Muslim in the world were to disappear, which was going to happen when Daoud returns, the world would be a better place. But I'm not pulling the trigger, and you ought not either. You're entitled to defend yourself. You're not entitled to push people's buttons like that. And so in front of riotous crowds of enraged Muslims youth, they responded in kind. In other words, it became a battle of words. And so there is some complicity on Israel's part. The world, of course, doesn't think Israel has a right to defend itself, that somehow its response has to be symmetrical. And so the Muslims, of course, is having no economy, having no industry, being completely uninventive, are throwing stones and Molotov cocktails. Jews are responding with tear gas and rubber bullets. And the world is screaming out against Israel. That's not fair. You're sending those poor kids to hospitals. Hamas has sent 1,000 rockets into Israeli civilian areas. And Israel attacks the specific sites where the Hamas leadership is and where the rockets have been launched. And they even leaflet the community first and said, you need to get out of here. We're going to respond based upon who's authorized the rockets and where they were shot. But the Muslims, they were never given a reason to live in Islam. They were only given a reason to die. They forced the women and children to stay there so that when those buildings are destroyed, they die with them.
I can see. Yeah. Propaganda.
Yep. So there you are. And that's what's happening. Now, we know that the world is going to go to war against Israel. We know that the time of Jacob's troubles becomes intensely severe around the midpoint of 2029, and that there will be a very sharp buildup to it beginning in the fall of 2026. But that's where the world is headed. Becoming increasingly irrational, increasingly anti-Semitic, and right now Israel is on the brink of its fourth war with Muslims, and this one's the worst of all because the Muslims that they are fighting are inside. Now, I would like to say one other thing. George Bush, go to hell. George Bush is the one that forced Israel to relinquish the control over Gaza. Mm-hmm. At the time, the Gaza was exceedingly productive in terms of agriculture. It is not anymore. Gaza is now a Hamas-controlled territory. The Jews have no control over it. All the Jews do is have checkpoints to try to minimize the amount of tunnels that are dug into Israel for the terrorists to invade, and the amount of weapons that are confiscated in. And so we're dealing in a situation where now, because of George Bush, there are no longer Israeli troops in Gaza. And so what did Gaza do? The Muslims in Gaza began to build tunnels to terrorize Israel. They fly balloons and kites into Israel to set fire to communities and to large swaths of territory. And they build rockets and they send rockets 100 at a time. Now it's already been 1,000 rockets. And when Israel responds, Israel is condemned for the response as opposed to the Muslims for sending the rockets. This time, Netanyahu and Gantz said, you know, enough's enough. The world's requesting us to de-escalate is wrong. We didn't pick this fight. They started it. They've been belligerent in continuing it. They continue to send rockets in. They continue to send the petrol bombs over. They continue to riot within our communities. They burn synagogues. We're going to continue until Hamas leadership is neutralized. That is our only chance of survival. So this is where we are. Now, I am a fan of two things. I'm a fan of Yahweh. Yahweh's a fan of Yisrael. I don't like to disagree with Yahweh on anything. I have found that his perspective, his reasoning is sound. I like him. Fact is, I've devoted my life to conveying his message, the greatest mission a person could possibly have. And so I am biased. My bias happens to be with God. He created the universe, shared with us all we need to know to engage in a relationship with him. I have done so. So have so many of you. And I just agree with him. Therefore, I know the story of the Philistines. I know they're gone. I know that there is no such thing as a Palestinian. And I'm quite certain, absolutely certain, as is Yahweh, that the two-state solution the United States is still touting is not the two-state solution. It is the final solution. It will be exactly as Neville Chamberlain sought peace in our time and gave the high ground of Czechoslovakia to the Nazis to appease them. And within 6 months, the world was at war. Israel is not defensible. Should it, after having given up Gaza, were to give up the West Bank, it will immediately lead to war. And this war will not just be an Islamic war against Israel. It will engulf the world. That is where the final solution. The second thing that I'm fond of is the truth. I do not accommodate lies or liars. If you have to lie to make your point, you have no point. If you have to claim that you're a Palestinian, if you have to claim there's a place called Palestine, if you want to claim that the Jews are occupying your land, if you want to claim that UN 242 is valid, then you're a liar. Whether you're ignorant or just stupid or ill-informed, I don't much care, because you're willing to act out against the truth, what's reasonable and fair with your agenda. So those are my thoughts on what is happening. I do not see this the way the world does, as a gray area. I read a BBC article. I wanted to puke with them talking about what they obviously do not know, and they've said it so many times. It's kind of like the Black Lives Matter protesters. They continue to lie to one another so often that the ignorant today, those that I guess have been so dumbed down that facts no longer matter. believe it. And so the world believes that there are Palestinian people, that they deserve a homeland, that there's a two-state solution. Those are my thoughts. What are yours?
Well, I agree. We've talked about this.
Pretty much 100% on.
Yeah, I mean, all the history is correct. It's nothing, no fallacies there. That's exactly what happened. It's very easy to prove that's what happened. I don't understand people being like that in so many, in such large numbers, to be honest with you. I know they are, but I have a hard time grappling with the horror that you kill just to kill. I mean, that's back to the days of Noah, killing just for the fun of it. I mean, I did read an article. JB, I'll just say one more thing. I did read an article about the dome thing, that what they were working on in Grumman and so forth. That can't save Israel. Yahweh can save Israel. Mm-hmm. That cannot save Israel. There's not enough bullets for the millions that are coming. I don't care whether they go 160 miles versus whatever.
Hamas has learned something that Hezbollah has known for some time. The Iron Dome is exceedingly effective. It, if 20, 30, 40, 50 rockets are sent into Israel a day, it will track which ones are going to land in Islamic territory. Like, for example, a few days ago, one of the Hamas rockets took out the only power plant in the Gaza area. And so it left countless people without electricity. A huge percentage of the rockets don't even make it out of the Gaza Strip. But what they have found is that if they send 100 rockets at a time, the Iron Dome can't function.
Can't deal with that number.
Can't deal with that number. And here's the problem. Because the United Nations has aided and abetted Hezbollah and Lebanon, because the United Nations is exceedingly anti-Semitic. Hezbollah in Lebanon now has 100,000 rockets, Iranian rockets. They will send 1,000 rockets a day for 100 days. Israel can't. Stand. Remember, I read Yeshaya 17 and 18, I said, Yahweh's using the term flood to tell us that so many Muslims are flooding into Israel that there aren't enough bullets to stop them. Well, there's not enough Iron Dome intercept rockets to stop the 1,000 rockets that will be launched into Israel today. And so you might say, so why call Israelites, Yehudim, back home if the situation is this dire? And the answer is that just as Israel overcame overwhelming odds in 1948, and again in 1967, and again in 1973, they will overcome enormous odds once again. And this time will be different in one way. Yahweh intervened for his people. He promised to that they would survive, and they will. But this time, something's going to be different. One is that the Haredi Jews, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, are so out of touch with reality that with the country burning and them not willing to do anything to defend it, people will turn on them. The stories of them sexually harassing women are so grievous. Their idiocy is so overwhelming that people will begin to turn on them. And second, it's going to get so dire even in Israel that finally the Jews are going to turn to Yahweh. We're going to see a Hezekiah moment. And whatever degree we play to encourage that, the better. But that's what's going to be different. But I know that the king of Mitzrayim, this crucible of oppression, will not permit those in accord with you, except to free those in accord with you, except by a powerful and firm hand. This was Yahweh's declaration in what is now recorded as Shemot Names, called the Book of Exodus 3:19. I'm struggling now with the name Exodus, just as I struggle with the name Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy means second law, and of course there's only one Torah, and it's not law. Exodus is a Greek word. Yahweh's term, is Yatzah for this event. It means to withdraw, to remove. There are some things in this statement that are exceedingly important for us to appreciate. The first is Yahweh uses one of my favorite words. It's the word that serves as the verb behind this whole series of books that we have composed. In fact, the chapter we're speaking of now is the second chapter in the Vikre volume, within 50 pages of completing the Mikre volume. That gets us through Akutam. It will not get us through the end of the Mikre. That'll be another volume called Moed. But that will be now, I think, the 16th book that has been rewritten in the new series. And there are days where I just sit here with goosebumps over how profoundly better, how many more insights we're able to derive from Yah's word after all of this time studying it. So in this particular statement, Yahweh uses the word that launched all of this, the verb that directed at the name, yada, yada, it means to know. Typically, it's not in Yahweh's voice, but here it is. God is saying, I, yada. It's yada ani. And matter of fact, the verb wasn't even, didn't necessarily have to carry the pronoun I, because it's one of those cases where to emphasize who is speaking, it is yada ani. I know. I have personal knowledge. I am aware. I recognize. Wa yada ani. Key, that indeed, truly, verifiably, assuredly. Now, normally, Yahweh refers to the dictator, political and religious dictator, the owner, if you will, of Mitzrayim, as Pharaoh, providing us with the proper pronunciation of the name of the Egyptian leader, 2,400 years before the Rosetta Stone told us how to transliterate those same words. But it is Pharaoh in Hebrew. But this time he's using the term for leader, Melech, king. But I know that the king of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is as important a concept as there is anywhere in the Torah and Prophets. Mitzrayim explains the purpose of Pesach and especially Matzah. Once you come to understand what Mitzrayim represents, then you understand from what Pesach and Matzah are withdrawing us. It is truly amazing that the frequency that Yahweh uses Mitzrayim, the plural of Mitzra, it's based on the Hebrew word shur. Shur is the Hebrew word that is used to explain the time of Jacob's troubles. Troubles is sure. It's the same word that Yahweh uses relative to what's going to happen after Israel is thinned at the waist in years upcoming, either 2026, 2027, 2028, when the West Bank is given to the Muslims as to appease them. He said that sure is going to happen. You're going to be constrained. There's going to be terrible trouble, affliction, agony, persecution. And so the basis of Mitzrayim is sure. Persecution, oppression, subjugation, and all of those terms are broad-based. Individuals do not persecute. Individuals do not oppress. Individuals do not subjugate. Countries do. Civilizations do. Religious institutions do. But as an individual, I may not like my neighbor. I'm really not in a position where I can lock up my neighbor and turn my neighbor into slaves. But countries do. So when we talk about Shur in the sense of Mitzrayim, the plural of it, and the myth encourages us to think and ponder about it, the implications of it, we're dealing with institutionalized, nationalized oppression and persecution. Mitzra also is a crucible, a cauldron. So this is what Yahweh is freeing us from. It's a crucible of oppression, a cauldron of persecution and cruelty, where people are confined and restricted by religious and political institutions. The reason that's so important is that is what Yahweh is yatzein, is the English verbal change, his people. He is yatza, his people, on Pesach and Matzah, particularly on Matzah, from religious and political persecution. That is what he's freeing us from. And that's why it's so essential to correctly render Mitzrayim and don't change it to a Greek word that has no meaning, Egypt. No. I know that the king of Mitzrayim, of this crucible of religious and political oppression, will not, wallow, permit Nathan freely release those in accord with you to go, a lock, to walk away, except by a powerful and firm hand, a shazak, a firm and resolute authority. What's interesting here is that Yahweh uses Yad Shazak throughout this testimony. The only place he uses it. And what it's basically saying is that political despots think they're too big for their own britches. Unless you're firm with them, you're going to get nowhere. I'm going to have to be firm with them. But I'm also going to have to be firm with my people because they have been conditioned over 400 years to act as slaves. They don't have any initiative. They've never worked for themselves. They've never been free to choose their own destiny. After 400 years of conditioning, if I were just to invite them to come out, most of them would stay. And so Yahweh knew that he had to save his people, that he had to withdraw them from this, not only because he had promised Abraham he would do so, but because if he did not do so, there would be no Torah, there'd be no prophets, God would be annulled. There was a lot at stake. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the few times that Yahweh intervened in free will. He says, it's going to be a resolutely firm hand that I'm going to withdraw my people. I'll use my unwavering influence against the king of Mitzrayim, and I'm going to use a very firm and resolute, steadfast hand to draw my people out. Isn't that amazing, though? But that's true. They would not have left. They bickered among themselves. They'd be so afraid of dying so that they wouldn't seek freedom. It is. If you want to say how is that possible?
Go back.
Yeah, that's true. But I will give you a situation today. People around the world, particularly in America, were willing to give up their freedom and their livelihoods mm-hmm. because of their fear of a virus. It killed 1 in 1,000 of the people that was affected. A fear of a virus, and they willingly gave up their freedom. So don't think it's something that's unique to these people or this time.
No.
Yeah.
No.
We witnessed it. Fear is a debilitating factor in most people's lives. It's why terrorism works. So political and religious leaders are covetous. They're power hungry. They're egotistical. No one tells them what to do or takes anything away from them without a fight. Therefore, those who compel must be compelled. I don't know if you've ever watched a movie on the last of the czars and how he responded to Lenin and to the very small minority in his country, but they think that they've got this divine right to rule, and they're covetous. They won't give it up. Those who rescind the free will of others must have their free will curtailed. For the sake of the innocent, those who oppress must come to receive that which they have doled out. I like fair play. I like the fact that God is vindictive. I like the fact that he's going to hold people accountable. You know, those who have advocated the destruction of Israel and have fanned the flames of anti-Semitism and what we're witnessing, I want them held accountable. I want the Roman Catholic Church held accountable for the hell they have perpetrated on God's people. So I will stretch out my hand and I will strike, knock on, I will afflict, I will smite, I will wound those associated with the crucibles of religious and political subjugation, Mitzrayim, with many of the astounding things of mine, that to show the way to the benefits of the relationship, I will do in their midst. There was a reason that God just didn't go into Egypt and say, all right, I'm going to pulverize the Egyptians, I'm going to take my people out. He could have provided every one of them with a wild Baraka winged ass. Could have flown right on out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, seriously. He could have transported them from one place to another.
He didn't do anything.
Yeah, he could have plunked them all out, put them in the promised land, clean house, and say, it's all done. There you go. But God chose to set an example. I'm going to show you what happens to those who oppress my people. I'm going to show you the attitude that's inherent in political leaders. I'm going to show you my overt animosity to slavery, to any human institution, whether it be political or religious, that seeks to control others. So through this experience, you're going to find out what I'm like and what I'm offering, because it's through Yahweh's outstretched hand and his willingness to strike at those who oppress, particularly in a religious and political culture, that God is committed to freeing his people. And he's going to do all of this to demonstrate the benefits of the relationship. Asha. And after that, rest assured, they will send you away. Now, God wasn't saying, hey, you know, I'm more powerful than they are. I'm going to win. No. He knew what was going to happen before it happened. He'd seen it. He knew exactly how this whole thing was going to play out. And yet, he allowed it to play out. And he allowed us to witness it.
Watch it. Witness, yeah.
So I don't know if you've analyzed any of the words or had a comment you wanted to make, either of you, on that, on these two statements. This is Shemot, the name, 320.
Let's see here. Well, I had an interesting thing. Just in that part where there was Chisok, I was just thinking about how I analyzed the letters and with the Chet to start with. And I usually use that as either separate or protect, so I thought I'd go and see if that's consistent. So I went through my verbs and nouns again on words that started with Chet, and with a Chet, rather. And it is 99% positive about protecting. So I thought it was interesting that it's a protective symbol that where people to the left of it going in the correct direction are going by a line of, like a plow going to a point, which happened to be the horizon, which is also with a Q on there, which I thought how easy, sometimes these words are quite easy to pick up what you say, what the lexicon say without having to, when you compare them, you go, yeah, that's exactly what it does. But that led me to one other little thing just by when I was looking through, I looked at one call because we're coming up to a really nice Chag festival feast. And Chag has a Chet in front of it, and then it has a Gimel going the wrong direction. And the only thing you can surmise there is the Chet, the fence that God puts around us, the protection that puts around us, prevents you from going. If you're participated in the festival feast, he is preventing you from going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So
you know, it's interesting.
I know sometimes they're just fun to play with. No.
When
it ain't a big note or anything, but I mean that's
it's fascinating. I was going to comment that you talk about we're trying to prevent us from going in the wrong direction. As Yahweh describes Bukhura, one of the things he says, "I'm going to assign. I'm going to dispatch for your on your behalf a malak and." Mm-hmm. That malak is going to have two purposes. One is that malak is going to shabar you so that you don't waver away from the way to me.
Cool.
And yeah, and then he says the other thing that that malak's going to do is that he's going to guide you and direct you to the home at the source of existence that I have prepared for you. And so God is saying, if you're on the path of the Mikra, you've celebrated Pesach, you've celebrated Matzah, you're enjoying Bukhurim, there is a Malak at that point helping you stay on that path.
Wow.
Working with you, enlightening you, protecting you, because there are so few people that are willing to communicate God's message, to be about his business, that the world hates them. And so God said, I'll assign a malak to you. They will enable you to stay focused along that path to me. Because I don't want you distracted. I don't want you pulled one way or the other. I don't want the world to undermine you while you're about my business. And then the second thing is, Malak is going to be involved in making sure that you're properly guided because I have established a makum that is kun, just prepared on your behalf. Waiting for you.
Wow.
Ready. So it's pretty cool. This was a that just struck into my mind because that's what you were just sharing. And God does a marvelous job of expressing exactly what these Mikrei do so long as we listen to him and his role in fulfilling in Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. It is also interesting that as I've now retranslated Yeshaya 53 that speaks of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, Mizmor Psalm 22 that speaks of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, and of course the presentations in the Torah on them. And there's a couple of things that become eminently clear. One of them is that Yosha is not a name. There's a reason that Yosha is not mentioned as a name in any prophecy, because it isn't a name. It's a mission statement.
A job description.
It is a job description. The thing that made Yosha effective as the Passover lamb, the reason that Yahweh was able to honor his promise to Abraham to provide the lamb is because Yahweh's soul was placed inside of the Passover lamb. Now, Yahweh's soul is not like your and my soul. In your and my soul, if our soul were to leave us, we'd be diddly eyed dead. Our soul is the sole repository of our intellect, of our experiences, of our personality, of our character, of our inclinations. It is literally the sum of our lives. The physical body is nothing but rotting parts and decaying parts that once the soul leaves, it isn't worth anything. In fact, it's a liability. But with Yahweh, that is not how his soul relates to him. You know, we are animals with a soul that animates us, that gives us the ability to observe our environment and respond to it. With Yahweh, his soul is, and I hate to use this term, but I like to use this term because it's a really descriptive term, it's an avatar. I don't like the term because the term came out of Sanskrit and it was used initially in the Hindu religion. But the avatar is not a god. It's just the ability of God to express his persona in our world. So the actual definition of the term is pretty effective. What I also wrote is that God's nefesh is like a very sophisticated version of the Mars rover Perseverance. That's the most recent we've sent to Mars. The Mars rover Perseverance has audio capability. We can listen to the sounds of Mars. It has cameras that allow us to see the environment of Mars. It has sensors that enable us to feel the temperatures and other things on Mars. It enables us to analyze the soils and the atmosphere of Mars. It is like we can go to Mars and experience everything that is Mars and project ourselves into Mars and interact with Mars without actually being in Mars. Yahweh's nefesh is like a very sophisticated probe. It enables Yahweh to experience what it's like to live as a person, what it's like to even endure Sheol. It gives him the opportunity to project his personality, his aptitudes, and his inclinations. And so, Yosha is had Yahweh's nefesh. Yahweh speaks in first person too many times. He says, I don't want you to corrupt the blood I shed by including yeast in its proximity. But it was the blood I shed. When Yahweh speaks to his people and say, you will look upon me who you pierced, it's obviously it was Yahweh's nefesh that was fulfilling Pesach. I had surmised that some time ago, but it's irrefutable. And so you get to that point of on Pesach, where Yosha is citing the opening lines of Mizmor 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that means that the spirit, the set-apart spirit of Yahweh, had withdrawn temporarily from the nephesh soul for that statement to be made. And
understood.
yet the moment the set-apart spirit, and we are told explicitly, she, our mother, took the soul and escorted it to Sheol. The moment she took the soul, the body died, serving as the Passover lamb, all done. All over. The body was even incinerated later that night. There's nothing to it. It has no value other than it served as the Passover lamb. We're now moving on. Don't look back. Eat your matzah. She takes the soul to Sheol. So at that very moment that she takes the soul, the body succumbs. There's nothing now of value to the body. Yahweh's soul as a probe, like the Martian rover Perseverance, can project Yahweh into a place he himself can't go, just like we as people can't go to Mars, even Elon Musk says, oh yeah, you know, I'm looking for volunteers. You're not going to live through it. You're all going to die. But, you know, it's a great adventure. You're still going to die. But we can send probes. Oh, Yahweh's nephesh is like a probe.
Yeah.
So it's just an interesting way that Yahweh himself fulfilled Pesach and Matzah, and then he is Bikurim. And what it tells you also is I was always convinced that Yosha had to be the fulfillment of Bikurim, the firstborn child of the father. But no, it's not. It's Yahweh's soul that reunited with Yahweh's spirit. There are no child here.
No.
There is an expression of how we are reunited spiritually and become spiritual children. But the only son who is Bakur is Dov.
More evidence there.
Yes. And by the way,
Yeah. Both
of the prophecies that are so explicit on what happened in fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bakurim, conclude celebrating Dove's return.
They're marvelous. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. God's story is really straightforward. He did it for Dove. Now, we can all benefit, but he did it for Dove. And God's great celebration where he says, you know, and you will look upon me who you perished, and you will mourn for me, weeping as if for a firstborn. Well, guess what? The firstborn is Dove. And it's not a firstborn who's dead. It's a firstborn who's alive. And what he means by weeping is, if you've ever seen a reunion of somebody that's been imprisoned in a faraway country, someone that was kidnapped, somebody you thought was dead, and they return, your emotions get the best of you. You're so daggone happy, you're crying. And that's what he means. That's the response. And it's God said we're all going to be doing that. And a lot of it's because we have so demeaned Dov, giving his titles, the Son of God and Messiah and King of Kings, to a caricature, that when we finally recognize the role he's playing, that he came back with Yahweh, that he wiped out all the dunderheads so that we could live and an earth transformed back into the Garden of Eden. And we see the great joy of Yahweh being with his beloved son. We're going to cry. Emotions will get the best of us. Anyway, that was a little bit of a detour into where we're going, but
we
talked
right
about it before. I'll just say that this growth of recognizing that Yosha is simply a mission statement, that his name is not mentioned in prophecy because he is simply Yahweh saving us. Whether it's his soul and that physical body as the Passover lamb, whether it's the experience of matzah, for the reunification of Bukhurim, it's Yamasol. And that's why it is Yosha, meaning Yahweh liberates, Yahweh says, Yahweh delivers. Well, the recalcitrance and reluctance of empires and despots to adapt to changing circumstances would be on display. It would take the plague of death to liberate the lives of God's people. The Israelites had arrived in Goshen with their possessions and their flocks. You know, they had come because of a drought that existed in the region, and of course, because of the great waterway that ran through the heart of Egypt, even in the midst of a drought, there was still water, and therefore they could still divert some of the river to make food. So they came there with their flocks. They came there with their possessions. They worked hard. They became prosperous. Jealous of their success, as we experience today throughout Europe and the world, the pharaohs, and just like the conspiratorial and the political and the progressive, stole everything that the Jews owned. They enslaved them. The religious regime had become rich by not paying them for the labor they were forced to provide as slaves. And God would rectify that situation. He says, and thus, for the people, I will grant favorable treatment in the eyes of the Mitzrayim oppressors. When it comes to be that you go away, you shall not walk away empty-handed. And turned out to be true. Now, was the compensation equivalent to the value of the possessions they brought in or the value of the work that they were not paid for doing? No, but they didn't leave empty-handed. They had provisions, mm-hmm. they had wealth, they had flocks. The Egyptians were more than happy to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, God is pro-recompense, fair is fair. His people would be compensated for their labor. And in the end, the people of Egypt were delighted to do so. Albeit the Pharaoh, not so much. The tone of the people's predilection is more conciliatory and polite than one would expect, considering the circumstances. It suggests that the hearts of the people were less calcified than their political and religious leaders. This is Torah Shemoth names, Exodus 3:22. A woman shall ask of those who live in this community, as well as a guest in her house, for supplies, for gold objects, for silver, for gold objects, as well as clothing. You shall entrust them by setting them on your sons and on your daughters, rescuing them from the crucibles of human oppression. God is saying quite simply that you're going to ask and they're going to give it to you. And that would be very hard for any of these folks to process, of course. You know, they'd been enslaved, they'd been beaten, they'd had their sons thrown in the river to drown, and now they're saying you're simply going to ask these people for things, and they're going to give you supplies, utensils, cooking pots, objects,
and
silver,
in your boots.
And gold, as well as clothing.
Mm-hmm. It's a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah.
True, but it's...
That's what happened.
Wow. Yeah.
The English translations typically render Kali as a jewelry and Netzal as plunder, making it sound like this was a preview of one of Muhammad's 75 terrorist raids where Islam's wannabe prophet robbed defenseless civilian communities by force of arms. However, neither connotation is appropriate. Kali speaks of ordinary things, cooking utensils, cooking vessels, utensils. To Netzal means to rescue, to deliver, and to save, not to steal. The Hebrews would be unarmed and defenseless. So the statement begins with a woman shall ask. I don't know why the religious have such a tough time rendering words accurately. Maybe it's because they don't like God and they want to make him seem like, well, you're going to plunder, you're going to steal. See, there's plundering in the Bible, so what's so wrong with the Islam? It's not what the words mean. Now, such malfeasance by the religious would calculate by those who despise the reputation of God and his people. But when they do so, it sullies the message. Ordinary people are always more humane and generous than the religious and political leaders. That is what's being said here. They made a request. The ordinary people came through. The worst in every institution and country and civilization are those who rise to the top. Personally aware of the disposition of the Hebrews and recognizing that they could be self-destructive. Boy, did Moshe ever know that. You know, when Moshe tried to save one, they turned against him. Yeah.
Who the heck are you, pal?
Yeah, that's why I've got so much respect for Moshe. I mean, he had it all. He was living the life of luxury, and yet he risked it all to keep an Egyptian taskmaster from beating a poor, enslaved, defenseless man to death. Talk about character. How many people would risk living in the most opulent palace in the world at the time, having even thinkable power and wealth, and you would risk it all to save somebody you don't know from getting beaten, and you're going to intervene against that the person that works for the very king that has showed you such hospitality, and you're going to risk it all to spare the life of an innocent person. And of course, when Moshe did, he killed the taskmaster. This is one of those great lessons. God chose this man who committed what was, I can't tell you it was premeditated murder, whether or not he said, I need to kill him or just stop him.
Manslaughter.
He probably knew the only way to stop him was to kill him. But there is one form of justified violence. It doesn't happen very often, but if you are witnessing someone who is...
Okay.
Physically abusing someone you know and love, or just someone who is defenseless, and you can stop it. That's an honorable thing to do. You know, if we've talked about this on this program, I say this all the time. If you're in a situation where you have a disagreement with somebody, you think somebody is acting improperly, use your words. Words are always more effective than fists, knives, bullets, bombs, or rocks. Use your words. The only justification for going beyond your words and getting physical, being violent, is if you are witnessing someone beating, injuring, raping, harming in a very severe way, a person who cannot defend themselves, it is appropriate to intervene on their behalf. It takes great character because you have so much to risk. And even then, it's got to be a bit of a calculus. Intervening if there are 10 thugs with guns or knives and you're not armed at all and they're raping some woman and you're going to say to intervene and try to hold them off as 10 armed individuals, you have no chance of success. You're simply going to die in the process. And so sometimes the only thing you can do is to find reinforcements to hold these people accountable down the road. But Moshe took a calculation, says, I can intervene, I can stop this innocent man from being beaten to death. And he did. So he knew that because when he went back to talk to his people, he heard them say, hey, you know, what's going to happen, you know, now that we saw you kill the Egyptian? You know, who made you God over us? Yeah, they, yeah, he.
Thanks a lot. Thanks
yeah, thanks a lot. That's why he left Egypt. He said, the very people I put my neck out for, that I risked it all to save, want to condemn me. That's why sometimes you look at Yahweh's love affair for Yisrael and Yahudah, and you say, really? I mean, these people, I understand that they're your people, but they've done to God exactly what they did to Moshe. God's done everything yeah. for them, and they said, who are you to be God over us? Excuse me.
Aren't we funny?
Oh, well, yeah, it's hilarious. Personally aware of the disposition of the Hebrews and recognizing they could be self-destructive and obstinate, especially after enduring the unrelenting yoke of their Egyptian taskmasters for 400 years, the hesitant shepherd posed a classical, but what if question. You gotta love Moshe. Then Moshe answered and asked, but what if they do not listen to the sound of my voice, nor trust me, but rather say, Yahweh did not appear to you? What if? So, Yahweh said to him, what is that in your hand? I love God's sense of humor. You know, if I were God, because I wouldn't be, I'd be crappy at it. I'd say, if I were God, I'd say, hey, idiot, I happen to be God. Would you give me a little credit here? Come on.
Don't you think I got a plan here?
Yeah, I got a plan here.
I got you covered, pal.
Yeah, I got you covered. What part of God did you not understand? If I can create a universe, chances are I can get these people to listen to it. Just a hunch I have here. But no, that wasn't God's approach. The fact is, God was is much smarter than we are, and God recognizes there's only one person on the planet that he could trust to do this job, Moshe, and he was already pretty squeamish. So I said, all right, we'll go at it a different way here. Yahweh said to him, what is that in your hand? He answered, it's a staff. It's a matze, which is a staff, a branch, a scepter. It's also a demarcation of the tribes. A staff! What is the staff indicative of?
Leadership.
Serving as the shepherd of God's blood. Mm-hmm. The branch, which is the most oft-repeated symbols for Dote, the Son of God, and the Messiah. The scepter. Now, what's that prophetic of? Dote's authority as a king over the tribes of Israel. What is that in your hand? The staff of the shepherd. The branch that is that shepherd. The scepter that was in the hands of that shepherd who became king. The one that would demark the tribes by breaking them all together. So with the shepherd's staff, the branch and the scepter held firmly in his hand, Moshe carried the promise and power of the coming Messiah, the shepherd and king. But without this relationship, the situation would have been dire. When Satan, depicted as the Nakash serpent, slithered out of the garden on his belly and was 4 feet dirt. Therefore, God said, throw it. Just toss it over there on the ground. Do it so now. So Moshe cast it to the ground, and it came to exist as a serpent, as a snake. Moshe fled away from his presence. I guess he didn't like snakes very much. I get part of the thing, too, is that vipers and the deaders were pretty deadly, but Moshe led. Now, in association with Yahweh, we have power over the adversary. And that is why one of the earliest Torah prophecies depicts a descendant of Jacob, likely Dod, striking a Satan's head, thereby exposing his venomous schemes. Now, personally, I'm not much of a proponent of miraculous show and tell. I've never asked God to prove anything by performing a miracle. No Gideon's fleece for me. I would rather find validation and insights in his words. It's a great deal more instructive. It's a lot more rewarding. And quite frankly, I think after having translated Yahweh's words to contemplate what he has to say, what he has done for us, asking him to prove that he is God after he has already proven that he is God, asking him for some sign that says, okay, we're on the same team is demeaning.
Mm-hmm.
It's like then, asking God's will for your life. What, aren't you listening?
Yeah.
So I just think it's demeaning. So I'm not a fan of signs of I don't even ask God, you know, for healing. If I feel sick, it's not God's business. It's not, you know, where he's not a magical genie. If we could ask God for demonstrations of his power of any time, who would bother to study? You know, if I could, I had lived with a lady today who accused me of trespassing. I said, oh, why don't you call the police? And she was just belligerent. And you know, if I could zap fire out of my mouth, she might have been toast. But you know, all I've got is words. And I'm just fine with them. And I wouldn't want any more power than that. Words are wonderful tools. Let's just use them. And I like Yahweh's symbolism here. It's just that turning God into do this for me, you know, like what Benny Hinn with his miraculous crusades, and he taps somebody in the head and they quiver all over and fall down. Oh, wow, the word you bullcrap.
Yeah.
If you need a miracle, like what Paul said, look at all the signs and wonders that I perform. If you are seeking miracles, you'll find them with Satan. God doesn't show up. So we have many more tools at our disposal than Moshe has. So, you know, I'm being a bit unfair to Moshe here. I mean, we can examine the written text whenever and for as long as we like. We can study the Torah. Moshe couldn't at this point. There was no Torah. We can study the prophets. God proves its existence. Moshe didn't have that. We have these marvelous tools that help us translate and understand Yah's words. And we have all of the history and the science available to demonstrate that what God says is correct. I mean, it's pretty cool that God said the Philistines came from Crete, and 2,700 years later, we finally find a Philistine gravesite. We do the DNA and find, they came from Crete. What are the odds? We can compare something God reveals in one place to every other place. He uses the same word or phrase. We can build a working vocabulary using a score of acceptable lexicons. Science, especially regarding time and light, ancient and modern history, archaeology, well-documented research, search engines are enormously helpful too. That's it. Moshe wasn't asking for a miracle. He was simply stating that there was the possibility that the Israelites might not believe him. In that case, he wanted to know how he should respond. Now, along these lines, considering what he would have done, Yahweh did not try to impress Moshe either. This was a learning experience. God was teaching Moshe that with the right approach, he would be able to move mountains. Even Israelites, which is a wee bit harder than moving a mountain. We see Yahweh giving Moshe control over the serpent. He would be releasing his lost sheep from the adversary's oppressive realm while establishing them as part of God's flock. This transformation to bad, from bad to good, from the serpent to the branch, to the scepter and staff, would be made as a result of Moshe embracing the full meaning of the Hebrew word Shazak. According to the most respected Hebrew lexicons, and you probably looked this up, both of you, that Shazak can convey succeed by being persistent and firm, even to be or to grow strong by being resolute, showing a tenacious resolve. According to other lexicons, Shazak means to prevail by being strong, even courageous. A third lexicon says that Shazak speaks of being powerful by firmly grasping hold of someone or something. To these thoughts, a fourth adds the idea of being willing to learn and then responding appropriately, repairing a relationship by being unremitting. Another speaks of a confirmation by being consistently earnest and assiduous, being diligent, circumspect, and persistent, thereby being able to overcome any foe. A sixth Hebrew dictionary defines Shazak as to control, to conquer, and to become victorious, possessing whatever ability is required to accomplish what was intended. A seventh speaks of possessing something which tightly girds and supports, encourages and empowers. So this Shazak firmness that Yahweh would deploy both against the adversaries and Mitzrayim and on behalf of him leading his people, that's an exceedingly important concept. That hand that's the first letter in Yahweh's name, reaching down and out to us with the open hand, that's a firm and resolute hand. That's like a father grasping the hand of a toddler and saying, if you hold my hand, you're not going to fall. If you hold my hand, we'll walk side by side. If you hold my hand, I will protect you. I will lead you to the most wonderful opportunities in life, the best I can provide. That is a resolute and strong hand. So we'll end with this passage because we're hold on.
Oh, that's right.
Still recording. It says, Yahweh said to Moshe, stretch out your hand and choose to grasp hold of it by the tail. And so he reached out with his hand, and by being persistent and firm with it, showing strength and resolve, he prevailed by gaining power over it. The Shazak hue. And by being intense with it, by willing to learn and respond appropriately to it, by being strong and unremitting, he triumphed and controlled the foe. And it became a staff, a branch, and a scepter in his palm. Oh, what a lovely learning a lesson that, you know, the worst that Satan can deal out. It can be transformed into the staff of a shepherd, the branch from which all life grows, and the scepter, which is the world's only benevolent king, a counselor that will has and will return to lead Israel. So when we look at this hand, is the most common Hebrew term for yod, for hand. It appears 1,631 times. Calf, only 127.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between them is that yod very commonly is used as a symbol for power and authority, especially gods. Calf and kafah convey the inverse of power and authority, which is to lower oneself and to bow down. The transformation from the serpent's realm to God's family, which Shasak describes, occurs because of the universal source of power and authority stretched out his hand and diminished himself to rescue us. There's a word picture of mm-hmm. redemption in this transition from yod to calf.
You know,
in comparison
of the two hands, the one that's reaching down, one is powerful. The hand itself, the reason you couldn't use it, if you're drawing them, you know, there's only a little bit of range of motion left to right, which is very limiting. Oh, I mean, my mm-hmm. arm can move my hand, but my hand can't move much. But it has a big range of motion going up and down, which is like bowing. So symbolically,
yes.
that makes total sense, whereas the reaching down and opening a hand, engaging the thumb and grasping, that's a whole other thing. So that's why you never use the cuff in that kind of relation, in that meaning. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it's the palm of an open hand.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Doesn't do much. So up and down.
Doesn't do much.
Like
yeah, it doesn't do much unless you can use your fingers. And if you look at one of the differences too is in the yod, the yod, which used to be a yod, the hand.
Yeah,
it actually
yod,
has
yeah.
the fingers separate.
Yes, open hand.
So
that
it's
grab something.
Capable of grasping. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. almost a little bit of the sideways version of that live long and prosper from Star Trek. You know. It's,
mm-hmm.
It's
correct.
Nah, I guess where they got that, but yeah, it's but you see fingers on the hand, so it's very powerful symbols, and what I have found is almost everything Yahweh says is there is a symbolic meaning to it. Like when God's first talking about Bokotim, and he said, when you come into the land, I want you to bring into the family home of Yahweh your Bokotim. And it's Bokotim from your Adama. And so is God very plainly saying, you know, the first fruit that's grown in your soil, yeah, bring into the house of Yahweh. Okay, that means it could be given out as sustenance for those who were disenfranchised and so on. But if you take those words and you translate Bokotim directly, which is firstborn children, and you've got Bo, which is to come into and be included, and then you've got Bereth, which is the family and home of in this case, Yahweh, now you have something that is, rather than mundane, profound, that the purpose of Bokotim is to bring your children into the family and home of Yah. So there's so many of these things where there is a very simple, mundane, okay, he had a staff, he tossed it on the ground, it became a serpent, he picked it up, and it became a staff again. Big whoop.
Sorry.
Now, if you understand what the serpent represents, and you understand that it's a staff, it's a scepter, it's a branch, and what they represent, and how one can transform something that is negative into something positive by your trust and reliance on Yahweh's instructions, doing what Yahweh asked us to do is what made that transformation. Then you've got something profound, and that's the fun of studying the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there was another thing about the staff. Let me tell you one real quick thing. The staff, the root word means to a brush or to sweep. And I thought how ironic how perfect, because he takes, Moshe lifts up his staff and the set apart spirit sweeps them away. And it's exactly what Doeg, I'm sure Doeg's going to have a stab in his hand. He's going to lift up and just wipe out all of this religiosity and this terrible world that's descended into hell as we live it. You know,
yeah,
so,
he's going to the world safe for God's children.
Yeah.
And think about how important that is, because God's children right now are being terrorized by the religious and by the progressive. Being terrorized by them.
Yeah.
You know, the only head of state that had a clear, definitive statement about what was going on was Putin. You know, everybody else wanted either they were just pro-Muslim and say, the terrible atrocities that are being perpetrated by those dastardly Jews, and they have to be stopped, and the courageous Muslims that are standing up to them. May Allah bless them. You know, that was the Islamic world. And, of course, the criminal court says, we're going to prosecute Israel for attacking civilian areas, as if there was any other form of combatant in the Islamic world.
They don't have a military.
They don't have a military, so
they're
all civilian. Okay, clueless. And then the United States saying, we're still a proponent of the two-state solution. And we condemn the rockets with the strongest terms, but, you know, we want the de-escalation. Everybody's mealy-mouthed, except Putin. He said, my advice is the Palestinians need to stop warring with Israel. That was it. Full stop. My advice is they need to stop warring with Israel. Because what? He knows, Netanyahu says, we didn't ask for this.
No, we didn't pick a fight.
We didn't pause it. We're responding. You don't send rockets. We are not going to bomb Hamas leaders. Stop sending rockets. We stop sending bombs in response. Pretty simple.
Fair enough.
Putin, I get in trouble with him all the time because there's things that Putin does that kind of cracked me up. I realize he's a thug. I mean, I get it. And that, he is not a good guy. But the fact is, when it comes to world leaders, they're such a rotten lot that about the only guy that's actually entertaining is Putin. And this is one of the cases where Putin got it right. He just says, I advise them to stop warring with Israel.
Well, remember when he pretty much put a stop to them destroying Damascus. He said, no, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
He came through there, too.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
So
Interesting.
Let's hope that the next week brings some calm and that there's not a civil war in Israel. Or if there is a civil war, that something good comes out of it, which is Israel realizing you cannot coexist with Muslims. It's just not possible. They are indoctrinated by Muhammad and Allah and the Quran and Hadith to be terrorists, to be anti-Semitic, to hate Jews. The Quran is a more anti-Semitic book than Hitler's Mein Kampf. Muslims, because Muhammad was a terrorist, perpetrate 95% of the world's terrorist acts. There is no moral equivalency here. And so let's hope that something positive comes out of this. But as we all know, the world's going to continue to disintegrate over these next 12 years until Dode's glorious return with Yahweh.
Yeah.
May Yah bless. We'll look forward to being with you next week. Hopefully we'll have a shorter segment on the news because there'll be less to talk about. When it comes to the defense of Israel, that is our responsibility as covenant members. One of the things that was just as a thought here, that as I'm reading about the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Makkorim, while it is possible for a foreigner, a Goer, somebody from a different ethnicity, like myself, like all of us here, not many of the listeners are, of course, Yehuda, but I'm not. And what God says is that, you know, a foreigner can participate, but that foreigner has to participate by being part of Yisrael, by choosing to live with Israel, to choosing to support Israel. If you're not a supporter of Israel, if you don't view yourself as among Israel, defending Israel, then you're not invited to participate. So you can, as a Goyim, participate and benefit from Pesach, Matzah, and Makkorim, but not as a foe of Israel. Those people who have these now anti-Semitic rants on their various conspiracy pages that claim to be a covenant are lying. They're lying on every issue across the board. It is only by being incorporated into Israel that you can participate. And they,
you have to hang with them, is the way it tells you.
Right.
If you're with them, then you're with them. Otherwise, you're not.
God has all sorts of issues with Jews. They've done a lot of bad things to him. But nonetheless, they are his people, and it's really simple. If you are opposed to them, then you're going to deal with Yah, and it's not going to be a pleasant thing. God does not excuse those who do anything that deprives his people of their liberty and of their rights and of their opportunity to know and love him. And you know who the greatest foe is, though, of Israel? The rabbis.
The United States? Oh, the rabbis,
no, the rabbis,
of course.
Rabbis.
They call it because they believe. They actually respect them for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the greatest foe of the Jewish people, or the rabbis. And so it's the Haredi that you know, whether they're wearing their black mourning coats or their the rat ass hats, what they do to their children, what they do to their women, what they do to their people, they're the greatest foe of Jews. These people that impose their religious edicts and are so dishonest, so hypocritical. And they have been given every opportunity. Every opportunity. And they not only squandered it, they've spit back in God's face. So they are the greatest foe of Israel. And the second on to them would be a close race. Today it's Muslims, but for most of the last 2,000 years it's been Christians. And then close onto that now is the progressive movement, the liberals and multiculturists who are only multiculturists if they're against the Caucasian male and opposed to Israel. Now they have this new modern race theory and new curriculums where, since the facts don't serve their conclusions or their agenda, we're just going to make up our a whole new set. And the sad place where we have gone. I just like one other political comment. It continues to amaze me that a president in so few days could do as many things wrong as the Biden administration has done. It's just been one ignorant, irrational, counterproductive act after another. They are doing their utmost to destroy America, and America will never recover from this administration and the destructive force that they have brought to bear on this country. And I do not say that as a partisan. We have no politics here. But one of the things you do recognize after a while is, since Yahweh is anti-religious and anti-political, that liberalism, which is a liberal use of government, is far worse than conservatism, which is a limited use of government. No use of government, and to use Yahweh's Torah, is the best solution. But if you're given the choice between maximizing government involvement and minimizing government involvement, conservative approach is better than the liberal approach. Where that breaks down, of course, is that in America we associate liberals with Democrats, conservatives with Republicans, and the fact of the matter is that there are no conservatives. There are none.
Correct.
So
correct.
It's inappropriate. It's appropriate to talk about conservatism being better than liberalism, but you can't then equate it to politics because there are no conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
The closest thing to it maybe, Rand Paul, did you hear what he had to say about his most recent spat with Fauci? He said there's just no journalists left in America because they're unable to ask Fauci the questions that I posed to him that caused him to have a conniption fit, which is, did you, as part of the National Institute of Health and your specific segment of that, fund the Wuhan lab in its virus research where this virus emerged? And Fauci, being the little snake that he is, says, we never fund gain of function in virus research. Rand Paul says, excuse me, I asked you a simple question. You couldn't answer the question. And the fact of the matter is that you didn't even need to answer it because the research of the gain of function, the star of gain of function in that lab, she's called the Bat Lady, she had a peer-reviewed paper, a series of them, where she wrote about the gain of function of this virus. And she stated that her funding came from the National Institute of Health. And yet we don't have anybody in America that's willing to ask you those questions or hold you accountable for being the fraud that you are.
Good for him. Good for him.
Occasionally there's a ray of hope.
Yeah.
Not often, however. I also think it's funny that, you know, all the talk show hosts, they're, of course, liberal, but I think it was Jimmy Fallon that now does a whole series of impersonations of Biden. He'll say, all right, so Boris, Angela Merkel of Germany, said, you know, we are trying to deal with the intellectual property issues on the vaccine such that we don't cause the companies that can save humanity from future plagues to die because no one wants to make a vaccine anymore if you just give away the intellectual property. To which he said, Biden responded, down there one day on the creek, there was twins. Their parents named them Ralph and Ralph. And if I recall, Ralph liked submarine sandwiches. And, well, now that's my – what were we talking about? Man is senile. I'm just – it's obvious. So, you know, who's pulling the strings in Washington? Because he's seen, I don't know if he has dementia, if his brain just grows up. It's a sad situation. And you'd have sympathy if they didn't prop up this numbskull as president. I mean, you know, if somebody...
I remember seeing an article a few weeks ago where someone, they came out and said that the views expressed by Joe Biden do not express the views of the administration.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much admitting he's just a puppet.
Yeah.
Don't listen to him. He doesn't represent us.
Yeah. The press secretary said we do everything we can to keep him from answering the questions from the press. They even went to the press before the first press conference and said, we want your questions in advance. I mean, they know it. Everybody knows it. It was obvious before the election. We brought it up countless times on this program. Yes, the comments made by Joe Biden do not reflect the opinions of this administration. Yeah. I don't know who's pulling the strings, but it's definitely not Joe Biden, because Joe was never the sharpest utensil in the drawer. But at this point, he's senile. Oh, well, nonetheless, nonetheless, he is the president that the progressives could not have even dreamed of. I mean, he even wants to raise capital gains tax. He wants to raise taxes on corporations. During coming out of a situation where you shut down the economy, and you want to raise it. No, so the economy is doing fine because the stock market is up. Stock market is valued with the currency that you debased. Of course it's up. The currency is not worth anything.
Inflation.
Jeez, you got to be a genius. Yes, and we want to push through a minimum wage of $15 an hour. That'll really help employment too, won't it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Sure. And then, you know, don't get me going. It's just all
no, insane. No, it just goes on and on and on. It's like,
yep.
How,
all right, good night,
boys
and girls. It's always fun. I look forward to being with you, JB, next week. And Kirk, may God bless, and let's hope that we have
a more peaceful
week in the news on behalf of Yah's people. Mm-hmm. And happy Shabbat. May God bless.
Yes. Shabbat shalom. Shabbat shalom.